I'm not a scientist. It's not my job. And yet, it's my worldview and it's right. my philosophy.
Podcast, I speak with Sasha Sagan, an author, science communicator, as well as the daughter of world-renowned educators Carl Sagan and Andrean. And today, naturally, we discuss humanity's connection to the cosmos. Sasha derives a great amount of importance to this spiritual connection we all have to the universe around us without the framework of religion, and we discuss the interconnectedness of it all. We also chat about the poverty of language and how things like spiritual or sacred are something we yearn for, yet these words are cemented with religious connotations even if we don't mean it. Sasha discusses the wonder and the beauty that the natural world can give us more so than the myths purported by pseudoscience, and how these facts of our world can and should influence our life. Not only that, we talk about the problem of education more broadly and how this can bolster a lack of belief in the scientific method. So, with that in mind, please welcome the sacred Sasha Sagan.
Mind-bending chemicals.
He wants to kill me.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
When you work on something and there's so much nuance that you're going over and over and with your editor and copy editor, you're just getting into the nitty gritty of like so much of it, and then it's done and you're reading it out loud, and it did feel like this culmination of all of this work. And I wrote so much of it while I was pregnant and when my daughter was, you know, in the first year of her life. And then sort of, you know, you send it in, it's done. If you get the galley, you get to see the cover, months go by. And then, you know, it was probably a month or two before the release, you do the audiobook, maybe 2 months, something like that. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, that, all that work, all that, all those decisions, now it's done. It's this finalized thing. And, you know, I mean, it is really hard. It's one thing to write about, you know, like, I mean, the loss of my dad and my grandfather and other people who I loved deeply, who I talk about in the book. And it's one thing to like write that down at your laptop, at your little table. And it's something, feels like something else to like say it out loud. Like, this is what I experienced. This is what I felt. This is why I still miss that person. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was, and you're doing it in a recording booth alone with it was like I had the director, the audiobook director on Zoom like we are now, and then the engineer who was so he really took pity on me. He was
Patience.
So sweet, and he would be like, "You're doing great," you know, silently, and I'd be like, "Thank you." but you know, it's not like you're reading it to your, you know, spouse and like, you know, you're with strangers. And It was just, you know, like everything in life, it's full of surprises and it's so different than you expect. And the things that made me emotional were not always the things I expected, but I did feel really lucky. And I love audiobooks. When I was a child, I loved being read to. I feel like that's such a beautiful, special connection with someone. And then you also have the other half of it, which is like anyone who's ever listened to their own outgoing voicemail message, like the sound of your
Do
own
I sound
voice
like that?
Is so totally different than than it sounds in your head. But it was great, and I was lucky I got to do it.
So before that, when you're actually sort of writing the book, you obviously have an idea in your head of, I guess, what you're trying to convey or communicate. But from a science communication standpoint, did you have sort of a goal or an idea on the manner and the way in which you wanted to communicate? Because, you know, you would certainly know all the different science communicators that sort of exist do so in very different ways, and it tends to work with them. Like, I just finished the book, The Order of Time by Carlo Rovelli, you know?
Yes.
And he's such... It's like you can read it like it's poetry. The analogies he does, he's a beautiful writer, right? And no one else can do it like that. But then again, you can read another scientific book, and if they had done it in a poetic sense like that, it might not have worked. And a bit more clarity and a bit more being clinical is actually called for. So what was sort of your approach, and how did you think about that?
Well, I really thought, you know, part of it is just your personality comes through. And that's like, true. If you were at a dinner party with Carlo Rovelli, I feel like that's how, I mean, I don't know, but in my imagination, that's how
please,
you
please.
Talk.
Hopefully,
yeah,
hopefully.
Exactly, exactly. Maybe someday we'll find out. But yeah, and you know, part of it is, I really want it to be accessible to people who don't think of themselves as, you know, philosophically science-minded. Mm. And I think that, you know, the two groups of people that I sort of imagined and hoped would read this book were parents of young children, of which I am one, who are trying to navigate, you know, a modern, maybe scientific, maybe skeptical, or just slightly more skeptical philosophy than what they were brought up with,
right.
With the urge to create special moments and celebrations and, you know, all the things that make up family life for their kids. So that was one group that I sort of imagined, and people who maybe were not, you know, really well versed in a lot of, you know, science, or it wasn't what they normally read, but wanted, you know, felt like there was something there that was meaningful to them. And then the other group of people who I think about all the time are the people who sort of identify as spiritual but not religious.
Mm.
And I think there's so many, especially around my age. I'm assuming we're around the same age, but you know, in the United States, and people who are skeptical of religion or have left religion or weren't brought up with it, and still feel this like connection to the universe. And sometimes I find that combination of values, you can get swept up in things like astrology,
yes,
or crystals or some other sort of new agey things that are not evidence-based.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, those urges, that the desire to go in those directions comes from a desire to feel connected to the stars and the planets and the earth.
Right.
And science really does provide that if it's presented in a way that's accessible and that's joyful and that's welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that doesn't always happen. And you sometimes get a little bit of a preaching to the unconverted,
yes,
I guess you
right.
would say. And so, I don't know. I just wanted to write something that would be welcoming and warm to people who weren't necessarily already aligned in the same mindset that, that the book sort of purports.
I mean, it's funny that the two things that you riffed off there were astrology and crystals, because I have, like, I always write down a few notes beforehand, and literally it says EG astrology and crystals right there. It's really perfect. I do want to say though that I mean, that's one of the things, the couple of things that I've seen that you've talked about and with the book as well, is you've made quite a strong effort to use the word spiritual, and a lot of scientists really make an effort in the opposite direction, right? They really try not to. And a couple of science communicators, I know Sean Carroll, Brian Green as well, they've sort of strongly discussed how much power that words themselves have, even if they're not meant to have that power. And spiritual is that one, right? You say the word and you automatically get a feeling of sort of religion, of all these other things. It's kind of like a word that's been hijacked a little bit. But all the same, is a totally human and important and, you know, fantastic experience that we all desire, we all want, and we all have.
Yeah.
So for you, I suppose, how have you walked this, like, really fine tightrope between the spirituality, not falling to the side of pseudoscience, but also not falling to the side of being too clinical, which is, you know, helping the pseudoscience in some respect?
Right. It's a really good question. And that word spiritual, I mean, magic, right? The etymology of magic comes from the magi, you know. Sacred is probably the word that I think most encapsulates what I want to communicate.
Right.
But these words come from monotheism. Mm-hmm. I mean, spiritual really has to do with breath, right? Spirit. And so you could make an argument maybe that that's not as monotheistic or religious as some of the other words. But I think, you know, maybe it's just the poverty of language. We just may not have that word yet, but that's the closest thing that we do have that communicates the feeling, whether it comes to you from a religious experience or looking up at the night sky or, you know, that first image we got a few years ago of the black hole, or just, you know, those connections that you, you know, some historical piece of information, some discovery about, you know, even through like the DNA kit, finding out something about your family that you never knew before.
Special.
That gives you goosebumps, right? That feeling of being part of this interwoven, enormous web that goes not just beyond our species and our planet, but beyond our solar system, you know, it's, I understand the urge to not borrow from religion, but I think the clarity of communication that is possible by using those words is worth it. And also everything, every belief system, every philosophy is built atop what was there before.
Absolutely.
You know, and we, whatever comes next, you know, and I'm not, I don't think, you know, oh, religion's on its way out and science is coming in and then we'll never have to think about religion again. I think these things ebb and flow. And I think that, you know, is not, you know, things tend to not go away forever. But
absolutely,
if there is some new thing ahead for people who are skeptical, who people who feel that science is the pathway to understanding, but still want that feeling of community and celebration and connection and, you know, all the tools that we've created as human beings to process change, you know, a funeral, a wedding, those things are not, they don't require belief. Mm-hmm. It's just part of being human. You know, whatever next comes next, for people with that outlook, we'll have to borrow some of the stuff that's already existing, because otherwise it can feel very contrived. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the alternative? We make up a word that means spiritual, but in a secular sense.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe, but it's fake. Hard for those things to catch on. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I totally, and you said something interesting before, which I suppose I think there's a bit of truth to, and maybe not totally true as well, which is the fact that you think a lot of these people that, I guess, gravitate more towards astrology or crystals or whatever it might be, some of the weird health trends that go out there, urine enemas and whatever else disgusting things that seem to occur. You said that it's quite often as a maybe a direct result of the fact that people are yearning for this sort of, I guess, universal spirituality a little bit. Now, I suppose what comes from that is an important question is, why do people fall to that direction and not to a more scientific direction?
It's such a good question. I think it's a matter of delivery. I think that the scientific community, and you know, there are great science communicators and there are wonderful, I mean, I'm very partial, but my mother writes and produces Cosmos, which I think does this so brilliantly. But in general, you know, when you're in school, at least in this country, science is like, there's a lot of, unless you have a really great inspired science teacher, which many of us have been lucky enough to have, but it's usually not all the way through. You know, it's like one or two along that road. You know, otherwise, if it's not presented in a way that gives you that tingle in the back of your spine, if it's not presented in a way where it's like, this is how you personally are part of this enormous, vast universe, if it's not, presented with that kind of enthusiasm and taught with that sense of interconnectedness, then it's just like a lot of rote memorization of formulas, or it can be. And, you know, there's so many elements of it that if you heard about it for the first time in the style that, for example, a great, you know, religious, a preacher, a really charismatic, joyful presenter can give, you know, this idea that, I mean, this is the example that I always give, but the idea there is a secret code in your blood that connects you to your ancestors.
Right.
And no matter who you are, where they lived, who they were, we now have discovered a way to decode this message in your body, and we can find out answers to ancient questions that we thought were lost forever. I mean, if that was like the beginning of the lesson on DNA in middle school, you know, you could, like, I think people would be more drawn towards that. And I think that, you know, it's I think so often things that feel scary, things that feel impossible to understand, it's easier to just block them off.
Absolutely.
And we have this idea of like cold hard facts, like the idea that if something is real and true and verifiable, it's unromantic.
Right.
And it doesn't give you the like mysterious, wonderful feeling. And the idea that things that we don't really understand that are mysterious, that's somehow better. And to me, that's like, it's like, would you rather like see someone attractive across the bar, imagine what they're like, never speak to them, or have like go see if it's the love of your life?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I think that there's something that we really miss out on when we sort of idealize the mystery rather than idealize coming to follow the evidence to understand something that's more astonishing than we could have ever imagined.
Right. And I enjoyed what you said there as well, which is like a bit of ownership of the scientists. And actually, all the best sort of science communicators that I've spoken to on this podcast and when I was at university as well sort of share that idea. You know, kind of for the first time, it really hit me. I had a podcast with a guy called Frank Marchis, and he's a senior sort of planetary scientist at SETI, which you'll be obviously very familiar with. And he was saying, we were discussing sort of climate change and maybe some of these other things, and he was really sort of taking the blame to the scientists, which was an interesting thing that I had never really saw before, but is completely important and pertinent, and something that any sort of scientist or teacher or educator should be thinking of the whole time. And I guess sort of opposite to that, and to play devil's advocate with it a little bit as well, is these people who happen to go quite hard in the pseudoscience side of things, astrology, crystals, all the things we mentioned before, they also happen to be the ones that go against science the most as well. So it's obviously quite complex, right? So it's not only that they're trying to find this universal meaning, there's something behind there that sort of makes them dislike science, whether it's, I guess, structure or some form of freedom. I'm not sure what it is.
It's an interesting question. And I mean, of course, and maybe I should have said this before, in terms of the really joyful, beautiful, quote unquote, spiritual presentation of science, I mean, I think that my dad, my parents together did that so beautifully. And my mom continues that legacy. And for me, growing up and having that as the way it was presented to me, it was like science, you know, I'm not a scientist. It's not my job. Mm-hmm. And yet it's my worldview and it's my philosophy. And I think that there are a lot of different ways in which people can sort of take some of that into their lives and learn, you know, science as a method for seeing what can stand up to scrutiny and what can't. And not necessarily seeing it as their career. And
right.
I think we don't have that as much as we could, you know, just as every Catholic is not a priest, you know what I mean? People who subscribe to the philosophy
point.
But do something else in their regular day. I think that there's something there that, you know, we're sort of missing. And in terms of what you asked about, you know, this sort of skepticism, I think there's, you know, it's some... So, and I don't want to put all the blame on scientists.
Of course not.
But I think that there's, you know, part of it is an education system, at least in the United States. You know, part of it is, I think, you know, if you grow up, I think a lot of it has to do with how much children are encouraged to ask difficult questions.
Absolutely.
From early childhood, you know, it's my daughter is in this stage now, like, why, what's this, what happened, well, what about this, you know what I mean? And I think that it brings out something in the parent where there is an urge to have all the answers. And when you don't, when they ask a question to which maybe you're not sure, or you don't know. There's this kind of defensiveness that can pop up. But I think if people were to say to their children, you know, that's a really, really good question. I don't know the answer. Let's go look it up. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, that's something I'm actually, you know, if it's a philosophical question, like that's something I'm actually conflicted about.
Yeah.
I don't know. Sometimes I see it this way. Sometimes I see it that way. And I think even from a really young age, if you treat children like they can understand complex ideas, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, when we are willing to, you know, say we don't know everything,
right,
and that there are some answers that we may never get, and that we have to sit and tolerate some ambiguity, which is something that I write about and something my parents taught me and many other people, this idea that sometimes we have to sit with the discomfort of not knowing. And for the scientific method to work, that's required, right? When we have a question and we are pursuing an answer, until there is evidence, until there's information, we have to sit with the discomfort of not knowing.
Right.
And in everyday life, I think that that's just so often a struggle. I mean, we all, you know, you send a work email, you're waiting for a response, whatever it is, that feeling of, I don't know what's going to happen. Oh, you know, the big things and the small things.
Yeah.
It's really hard for us. And I think that because, you know, science is not a list of, you know, steady things, you know, it changes.
It and tries the things to be. That we,
yes, it tries to be. But the things that we believed 100 years ago, you know, now there's so many that are laughable. And that's part of it, is a pursuit of better new information, which makes the ground a little unsteady sometimes, you know, versus a religious or maybe new age mindset where you have one person or one authority, or your local leader of your congregation or the person that you go to for spiritual guidance who says, this is how it is, and this is how it's going to be. I think that there's something that is soothing about that. And, you know, I think the fact that science is a moving, it moves, it changes.
Yeah.
And that, yes, there are things right now that the most cutting edge information we have may be totally... you know,
behind.
Debunked. Yeah, exactly. Just
sure.
Completely wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that can be really hard, especially if you are not brought up from childhood with a sort of encouragement of asking deep, difficult questions that don't always have firm answer.
Yeah. And I think that's an important reflection that you're talking about there as well. Like the human aspect of science, like, and the warmth of science, like, we're kind of trying to get rid of that clinical coldness of science, that obviously it has to have a certain amount of it, but maybe the approach to it is different. And as you were saying just before, you've been sort of very open with how much admiration, how appreciative you were of your parents in the way that they've taught you, and also in the way they were communicators with cosmos to on a grander scale, and obviously some of the books that your father wrote as well, some of the most incredible books that people still read today. I guess one of the things I wanted to ask about that, in a sort of different way, I could just ask, oh, do you see how much effect it has had in the world? That kind of thing. I don't really want to ask something too basic, because I'm no doubt you've been asked that question about 10,000 times in your life. But I suppose a better way to ask it is, throughout your time writing the book, just general life, seeing things in big pictures and in small pictures, have you, I suppose, felt the reverberations and the differences and the change that the communication that your parents had done in the strangest of places, I suppose?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, God, there are so many times, and especially now, I mean, now we're all sort of mostly at home,
right,
but on social media, you know, again, through the magic of science and technology, I'm able to have these conversations or see these messages from people on every corner of this planet. And it's just, there's one passage from Demon Haunted World that crops up often on Twitter, you know, written probably close to 30 years ago.
Yeah.
About our relationship with science and our ability to think critically. And there's so much there that I just, you know, so many people have written, probably more than any other book that my parents,
really?
Or my dad by himself wrote about Demon Haunted World.
That's interesting.
It's so much, I know, but it's so much about skepticism and about how we discern fact from fiction. And when someone's selling something or trying to get elected or, you know, or just is wrong, you know, innocently, but mistaken. And, you know, it used to be very, you know, when he was writing, alien abductions were like such a part of the national conversation of like, is this, you know, people had these experiences and, you know, and if it was 1,000 years earlier, it might've been, about a religious, you know, visited by an angel or a devil or whatever it could be. But like these experiences that people have where they feel that they are sure that something happened. And, you know, that book is so much about critical thinking and about how we navigate claims that come from someone else and try to figure out who's telling the truth and what is real. And I just think right now, at least in this country, that is one of the most pertinent topics that there could possibly be. And yeah, I think I would have to. I haven't perfectly, you know, done a notation, perfect study of this, but I think more than any other book, that book people have written and said, you know, that changed my life. And, you know, I get these anecdotes and messages and just gratitude for his work, for my parents' work, very often on social media and, you know, out in the world back in the days when we went places, occasionally someone would recognize my surname or something. And I would have these conversations with people. And I just think, you know, it's so amazing that now, you know, many years, it'll be 24 years in December, since his death, to have this impact on society and for it to be something that was so from the heart and so much a product of his passion and enthusiasm and love of science and love of, you know, one of his often repeated quotes is, I don't want to believe, I want to know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like that idea that like we are, our grasp of reality, you know, if we can just find out how things really are, it's just more astonishing than anything we could imagine. And I think that that passion and that enthusiasm and that joyous appreciation for nature really is what it is something that is something that people still really connect to all over the world.
Right. I mean, I will say just as a quick caveat that before I had the podcast with you, I promised myself that I wouldn't spend too long talking about how much sort of your parents influenced me on a scientific basis.
Oh, no, that's fine. Don't be shy.
But yeah, I absolutely, like, I found Cosmos quite late, to be honest with you. Like, I didn't finish school, so I never really had that much of a science background, but then I went to study science at university. But I remember I've read Demon Haunted World so many times, and that book has just, like, it's always just been a bolster for everything that I've done, and I always go back to it. And tons of times I feel a certain way about a topic, and I go, why is this springing to mind? And it's directly from the book. So I was surprised that you said it's had that much of an effect. I thought it'd be Cosmos or something. And
I think the TV show Cosmos, I mean, TV is just so, you know, when you see someone's face and they're in your home, that's a kind of connection that I think people, you know, it's almost more visceral in a certain way. But as far as books, but that's so wonderful to hear. I'm so glad told me that.
Well, I was going to say as well, like, you know, I've spoken to, through the podcast, a ton of different scientists. Also, I used to do kind of a lot of talks and stuff at university, and just about every academic who I've had more than a 30-minute conversation with has mentioned Cosmos or Carl Sagan or your mother as well.
That's so amazing.
Yeah, which is pretty incredible, pretty incredible. And yeah, you know, that's what I was sort of trying to get at with you before, that I guess it might sound like a bit of a stupid question, but
There are no stupid questions.
Well, that's true.
That's what my father would always
say. I shouldn't have said that. I wish I could suck those words back in.
No. But I mean, we all have that feeling.
Exactly.
But.
It may sound like a stupid question, but it's not, because there's no such thing. For you, like, why did you opt to, so I suppose, write the book and to care so much about science communication? And the reason I ask this is because you can get families, entire families, where the father, the mother, the grandpa, the auntie, the uncle, all doctors, for example. Yeah. And then the daughter or the son hates the idea of medicine and then goes on to be like a ballet dancer, or like just something completely, completely different. So for you, you obviously had sort of an evolution as you were growing up and sort of through your young adult life as well that made you go, this is the thing that really resonates with me. So how did that sort of work out?
Yeah, I'm not a very good rebel, am I?
Clearly. You made zero effort.
I know. It's funny. I think that, you know, because my parents were so open to questioning and philosophical debate, it wasn't like it was like forbidden. You know what I mean? Like anything that so it just doesn't, like, if in the family you're describing, if everyone's like, you have to be a doctor, and like, no, I'm a ballet dancer. It's like, that
satisfaction from rebelling.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. But because I didn't feel like I couldn't say, well, what about this? And you're wrong. And it was very, I didn't feel like I had to rebel in any way, because they were very open to being questioned, and they loved difficult questions, and they loved like a philosophical discussion and challenging their own ideas by having those kinds of conversations. Like, that was like almost, you know, family ritual in a way, like having sort of lively discussions and debates about, you know, deep questions. And I think that for me, the way in which I am different, or my focus is, I am really, you know, so much of my book is about the way we celebrate and the way we mark time and the way that the rituals and rites of passage that for millennia, the infrastructure has been religion. Well, how do we do that if we're not religious? We still need those moments in life. And I think because I lost my dad when I was 14, I had to really reckon with that idea, especially in terms of, like, you know, mourning and grief.
Right.
And if you don't believe that there's any evidence that you're going to see the person you love again, how do you deal? You know, and I think that obviously, I mean, it's the defining experience of my life was losing my dad at that age. And I think that sort of led me on this slightly parallel but different pathway that's a little bit, you know, more about, you know, the everyday experience of being a person. And if you don't want to go through the motions, but you still want to celebrate and mourn, all these things that are very human and very tangible in a way, how do you do that? And I think that what's so astonishing and what I can never get over is how much, as once I started researching all these traditions around the world and customs, how much they're just, they're only very thinly disguised natural phenomena,
right,
you know?
Right.
Right. That was what was, I couldn't get over it. The solstices and the equinoxes, you know, Easter and Passover and springtime and, you know, everything that takes place around the winter solstice and all these events. And then, you know, coming of age, all these gorgeous, elaborate coming of age rituals around the world, you know, down to like a sweet 16 or a quinceañera, you know, that is about a biological change, right? A child is going through puberty and will get to adulthood. And that is what it is. And that alone is sacred. I don't think you need, if you have faith, then wonderful. You have everything that you need for these changes and these big moments in life. But if you're secular, you know, it doesn't require anything else. That alone is amazing. Just like a birth or a death, like these are biological events and they are tangibly real. And I think that there's something so powerful about the idea that we can just celebrate what's actually happening with joy and enthusiasm, and we don't need the religious element if it doesn't speak to us.
Yeah, not needing to put the extra stuff on top. And it's quite interesting what you were saying about sort of, I suppose, how much of a defining moment it is to lose a loved one, especially a parent, right? And especially at a young age. You know, myself, my dad died when I was in my early 20s. A good friend of mine.
Sorry.
It's okay. A good friend of mine, his mother died when he was like 12 or so, like, so much younger than me, I guess, a more similar age to you. And, you know, with him, I've spoken about it on multiple occasions, how it's like this bizarre moment of clarity that you sort of end up getting, and it's also this thing that you sort of carry around with you that directs maybe the things that you think about and the way you feel about things as well. And that in itself is similar to what you're saying about like the Sweet 16s and stuff. It's like a real like sort of life moment that really changes things on a spiritual level that science can obviously explain in a certain respect. We can talk about the brain chemicals and things like that, but it doesn't actually explain the perception and the feelings of the human. And I think that's an interesting thing for us to reflect on.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, this idea in terms of mortality, I think, you know, I think it's one of the most taboo topics.
Absolutely.
You know,
completely agree.
And the idea that this is not forever. And even if you do believe, even if you're very devout and you subscribe to a philosophy that promises an afterlife, whatever that is, it's not this. So this will come to an end for each of us. And the idea that we put that out of our heads, or think that, well, there's something better coming later, I think that robs us of this blink of an eye that we get to share on this little planet in this grand universe that is, you know, so unlikely that any of us, you know, are born at all.
Yeah.
You know, all the things that have to happen in order to arrive at this moment where you, dear listener, are listening to this podcast, you know, it's so astonishing. And, you know, I think the idea that it's not forever, even though it's very painful, and the idea of losing loved ones and the idea of our own mortality is hard, it's more, there's also a way in which being alive right this second is more wonderful and joyful if we don't put the idea out of our head that it's not infinite. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's something there, you know, especially for secular people, I think there's not as much a discussion around, you know, death as part of life because we don't have a framework for talking about it, and because it's, you know, without a tradition that says oh well this is what will happen, it's sometimes just too difficult to even wrap our minds around. But when you've lost someone, and especially when you've lost someone when you're young, it's part of the way that you think about everything. And I think that, you know, as painful as it is, there is also an element where you can learn to appreciate being here right now more.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like you sort of mentioned, it's a way that we sort of shape the way that we live from that one moment. Now, we're getting to sort of like the last 10-ish minutes of the podcast. It flies by as always. And there's sort of one more thing that I wanted to ask you, mainly because this is sort of a personal frustration for me as a very amateur science communicator, but one that gets bombarded with messages from people all the same, sometimes kind and sometimes very, very angry from something that I had said or a guest has said in the podcast.
Right.
So I guess it's a simple question, but it's really important, is why should we even care about scientific literacy now? Because I often get a certain feeling, and I obviously from a meditative standpoint, I need to check why I feel these feelings. But, you know, when people really do double down on a lot of pseudoscientific things, it's really a part of their existence, and they're sort of aggressive in the fact that it's so important to them, and everyone else is wrong in some respect. For people like that, how could you explain or how could you emphasize the importance of scientific literacy? Why does it even matter?
It's such a good question. It's a really good question. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the answer that I would give is, well, the larger question is, does it matter what's true? I mean, there are some things that are subjective. We all have our opinions and ideas and experiences that are just to do with our own internal, you know, life, and that's fine. But the stuff that's objective, the stuff that can be measured and tested, you know, does it matter what's real? And I think that is the underlying question. And it's not that science has all the answers right now, but that it's a method for testing reality to see what is real. And it's like, if you rely, if you use technology, if you use medicine, if you, you know, drive a car, you know, any of these things that function in a certain way, maybe not perfect, maybe not 100% of the time, you know, get in an airplane, any of this stuff, if you're willing to take the leap of, you know, assuming those things are going to function properly, that is because they have been tested through the scientific method. And if you believe, you know, if you think that it matters that we, you know, the Earth goes around the sun and not the other way around, is that useful information? Is that good to know? Do you want to see where we are in the grand scheme of things? The things that we take for granted now that, you know, have long since been proven, right, let's say, and that we're comfortable with mostly, you know, I know there's some like flat earthers out there and
stuff, talk too much
but
about
like,
that.
let's say excluding them. But like, you know, if you're glad to know those things and that's useful and that is helpful and you're glad to use technology and you're glad to use medicine and engineering, those are all products of the scientific method. That is how we got as far as we have gotten, and it's not perfect, and there are some, you know, real shortcomings, and there are times when we have been dead wrong as a species, but it's the tool set to find out. And when something is new and different and we're just figuring it out, it is scary and people are uncomfortable. You know, see Galileo Copernicus, you know. But it is still, you know, we cannot run from the reality at a certain point. And I think that, you know, if the deep question is it better for us to get comfortable with what we can learn and prove, or is it better for us to just stay comfortable and not learn and prove anything new? To me, I'd rather for us to change with the information rather than keep ourselves in a bubble where no information changes, so that we don't have to ask ourselves anything that makes us feel funny or that is difficult to wrap our minds around. And I think so often, this is something that my mom talks about a lot, like this idea where we started out believing that we are the center of everything, that this world was made special for us, everything, you know, all the celestial bodies move around us. And slowly we've, as the shot has pulled out and we've seen more and more and more, we realize we are tiny,
right,
and we are on an out of the way little planet going around a not very exciting star.
Very average.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that is hard for us, but it's also what we are a part of. The enormity and beauty of the universe that we are a part of has become more amazing. But this is like, I mean, it's akin to growing up. You know, we have to go through a difficult adolescence and realize that the world does not revolve around us. You know, as any small child who has gotten a new sibling, you know, realizes really in sometimes difficult way, you know, it, all of a sudden we have to come to terms with that it's not all about us, but we are part of the fabric of a family and a community and a world that's really beautiful. And, you know, I think that that is parallel to what we are going through as a species, seeing ourselves in as a smaller part of something much bigger than we could have imagined.
Yeah, I was
going
to say that that humbling pathway that we're going down, it's a difficult pill to swallow. You know, again, mentioning when I had the podcast with Frank Marchis from SETI, he was just discussing with me how well they know how many millions of exoplanets there are that are similar to Earth. And I remember I almost needed the next day off work. Like, I was, just exhausted by it. It was really hard to take.
Drink,
Really, really, yeah. And I guess the thing that, just as the last point, it sort of bleeds into as well, is just like what we were discussing before we turned the mics on, right? Which is the fact that the situation with coronavirus is a lot of it is like it is as a direct result of the how much we trust our scientists, how much we trust our leaders, pseudoscience as a whole. And although there might be small things like these crystals or I guess certain medicines or astrology that might seem quite benign, but when you add them up in a greater picture and then you couple them with things that are more serious, such as vaccines or whatever else, it can be a lot more dangerous and effective on the planet.
Yeah, and I think we have this idea where, like, you know, right, a new disease, scientists are working, you know, epidemiologists are incredibly working to understand incredibly, but it's a huge amount of information. And yeah, the first thing that they maybe, you know, the first theory or the first approach doesn't work. And then the way that sometimes people who maybe are not as well versed in how science
difficult
you
the
know,
process
changes,
should
right,
be yeah.
exactly are like, well, they were wrong about this, so yeah. I'm gonna discount everything yeah. that is coming from this line of you know thinking. And it's like, well, listen, I'm all for skepticism, but when you compare people who have spent their lives studying how viruses spread versus, you know, in this country, somebody who has no medical background right. selling something or who's invested in something that has, and the idea that we put that on equal footing because one person has been seemingly sure all along right. and someone else is changing with new information. To me, the scientist who is changing their position with new information, that is the person who's more likely to get to a cure. And I think that we have this idea that, and maybe it's some deep human thing, maybe it's connected to our relationship with monotheism, but it's almost like we have this idea that someone who has total confidence that they are right without any evidence is more trustworthy yeah. than someone who is saying, I'm still figuring this out, but this is what we know so far. And I think that that is, you know, a very, very complicated thing that we're reckoning with right now. But I think when we go back and we look at, let's say, all the medical advancements that we right. have been able to make as a species, we know which pathway led to them.
All right, Sasha, we're about the hour mark now. So we've mentioned your book a few times, and when I release the podcast, I'll do an intro and talk a little bit about the book and where people can find it too. But just can you just let people know if they're interested in your book or interested in you as a whole, where can they go?
Yeah, absolutely. So my book is called For Small Creatures Such as We, and you can buy it wherever you buy your books. I mean, I'm a big supporter of small bookshops, if you can do that. and if you're looking for me on the internet, I'm at Sasha Sagan on Twitter and Instagram.
Fantastic. Perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm happy you're here to be communicating science to the world. I'm happy your
thank
mother's
you.
Still around, and I wish your father was here. We need him at a time like now.
Boy, I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much, Connor. This was really a pleasure. Nice
awesome.
Talking to you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the podcast, please subscribe to us. Go to any of our social media accounts or website. Tell your friends, tell your grandparents. Do anything you can do in your power to help us out, because it will allow us to continue doing this podcast for everybody, which we greatly appreciate. Thank you for the support, and see you next time.